and welcome to the reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for Saturday, September 19th, 2020. I'm your reader, Leanne Bakerose. Mason City sees success in blight concerns. A little more than a year ago, when Mason City Council members and city staff met to hone in on top priorities for the year ahead, there was a bit of a refrain during the brainstorming session. The need to address blight issues came up early and often. Out of that, city officials set a goal of addressing at least 40 properties with blight concerns before the end of 2020. Midway through September, the city is close to that goal. According to a monthly report read by City Administrator Aaron Burnett at Tuesday night's City Council meeting, since that September 2019 meeting, the city has overseen the demolition or renovation of what it calls 10 chronically blighted properties and is working with 10 more to reach compliance, while 15 others are starting the compliance process. The report went on to say that many properties didn't need to go through any kind of court proceedings because the owners of those properties were proactive in addressing the properties through renovation work or selling to another owner willing to make the needed investments. One of the main departments in Mason City working on the issue is Development Services. According to its director, Stephen Van Steenhuis, there are a few main compliance issues that qualify a property as blighted and in need of compliance. The first, obviously, is abandonment. There's no one taking care of it, and people can go in and out. It could attract various forms of crime and things we want to avoid, Van Steenhuis said. The second thing is lack of maintenance. That devalues the neighborhood. Also, it can be a harbor for vermin. Van Steenhuis said a particularly tough case of abandonment the city had to get involved with was a pair of houses on adjacent lots under the same ownership that had been vacant for a long time. The owner had passed away and that person's heirs didn't have an interest in the property, so that one took some time. We had to find anyone with interest in the property. We couldn't find the responsible party. We got a lot of assistance from attorneys, Van Steenhuis said. He acknowledged that his department and others in the city still have work to do on the matter. There are a few more. Some are worse than others, and we want to prioritize getting the bad ones out of the way first. And with that, the way that Van Steenhuis sees it, the city's been successful with what it had to do this year. It's made a dent in the number of properties that it needed to address in some way. We still have a lot of work to do, he said. I do think that some of the worst we've taken care, and I feel good about that. And beyond just the material benefits of blight enforcement, Van Steenhuis said thinks the work's important for immaterial reasons as well. We're really trying to work on perception that no one cares about the neighborhoods anymore, and we've made great strides towards that. 125th anniversary of Boland Church to be commemorated in Manly. Trinity United Methodist Church of Boland will mark its 125th anniversary at a service in Manly on Sunday. Bethel United Methodist Church will host the outdoor service at 9 a.m., with a streamed version to follow at 10:30 a.m. on the Bethel of Manly Facebook page. Members of Trinity will provide the music. A celebration planned in Boland has been pushed back to next year due to the pandemic. Bethel United Methodist Church is located at 503 East South Street in Manly. Iowa DNR reports busy year for pheasants and hunters. This may be a banner year for pheasant hunting in Iowa, with both the number of birds and the number of hunters predicted to be the highest in a decade. The Iowa Department of Natural Resources annual roadside survey of pheasants showed an 18% increase in 2020 over 2019. The average number of pheasants spotted per route, 20.3, was higher in the early August survey than the state's 10-year average of 15.3. Overall, pheasant hunters in the Hawkeye State should expect significantly better pheasant numbers in 2020, the Iowa DNR reported. Six of the nine survey regions reported pheasant averages of 20-plus per route. Iowa has not had six regions report 20-plus pheasant averages since 2007. The Cedar Rapids Gazette reports that since 1962, the Iowa DNR has been doing a roadside survey of ringneck pheasants and other animals, including bobwhite quail, gray partridges, and cottontail rabbits. Surveyors drive 6,000 miles over the first 2 weeks in August, covering 215 routes of at least 30 miles each across the state, said Todd Bogenschutz, the department's upland wildlife research biologist. Surveyors go out on dewy mornings because pheasants don't like to be wet, and hens usually take their chicks out to gravel roads to avoid the dew, Bogenschutz said. It should be a morning with a real heavy dew, no winds, and sunny, he said. Eugene Klonglin, an Iowa State University professor, standardized the survey method in 1962 when he said pheasant counts should be done in August, before the chicks get too big to distinguish from adult birds and before crops are harvested. Pheasant populations are higher this year because the 2020 winter had mild temperatures and little snowfall, leading to a higher hen survival rate, Bogenschutz said. The dry spring made for more successful nesting. Lines are history at Iowa driver centers. The DMV jokes, at least in Iowa, can be put to bed. You know, the ones that follow along the lines of, it took so long to, insert task here, it was almost like waiting in line at the DMV. The list of punchlines was seemingly as endless as, well, the wait at the DMV office. The COVID-19 pandemic has us all longing for a return to normal. But if there's one positive to come out of it, it's this. You don't have to spend hours waiting to renew your driver's license in Iowa anymore. It's a way different environment, said Katie Fertig, Service Center Supervisor 2 at the Iowa Department of Transportation's Driver's License Service Center in Sioux City. On August 26th, the Iowa DOT announced that walk-in service no longer will be offered at its driver's license service centers. Customers now must go online and sign up for an appointment, as they have been doing since March 16th, when the Iowa DOT initiated the appointment-only model in response to the coronavirus pandemic. The Sioux City Journal reports the move was already something the Iowa DOT was planning to do, but the pandemic pushed up the implementation. After an adjustment period, officials began noticing changes. No longer forced to wait for who knows how long, customers were happy. Not having to deal with frustrated customers, Iowa DOT workers were less stressed out and were completing just as many transactions as before the walk-ins were halted. It really got our attention, said Melissa Gillette, Iowa DOT Motor Vehicle Division Director. When the 5-star service reviews began popping up on Google, something never seen before, the folks at the Iowa DOT knew they had made the right decision. With a set appointment time at, say, 2 p.m., a customer can come a couple minutes before, check in, and be gone in 10 to 15 minutes. Want to come in over your lunch break or before work or school? You're now nearly guaranteed to get where you need to go on time because you don't face an uncertain wait time. You are now actually able to get in and out, Fertig said. A visit to the Sioux City Service Center on Wednesday showed a waiting area full of empty chairs. Most customers barely had the chance to settle into their seats when their number was called to go to one of the 5 service desks. Ben Dreesen of Kingsley had made an appointment to renew his driver's license in July. He showed up Wednesday afternoon, waited maybe 3 minutes before he was called, he said, and was out of the office in no time. I think this is a lot more efficient, he said, of the new appointment procedure. I don't mind it at all. It's not for everyone. When asked what she thought of the new procedure, a woman who didn't wish to be identified said, "It sucks." She's been back 6 times this summer in an effort to get her CDL license, she said, and each time she's had to wait weeks for an available appointment time. Gillette acknowledged the shortage of timely appointment slots. Operations were slowed down during the pandemic's early months, and many people put off license and ID renewals, so there's a backlog. You might have to schedule your appointment up to 90 days out, similar to setting up a doctor visit. That doesn't mean you have to wait for weeks. Fertig said that when the Sioux City office opens at 8 a.m. each day, 100 to 150 appointment slots are already filled by people who scheduled days or weeks earlier, but every morning about 60 to 100 same-day slots are made available for people to claim and get same-day service. An increasing number of people have chosen to avoid the scheduling process altogether and have opted for online rather than in-person license or ID renewal. Gillette said that prior to the pandemic, about 400 people per week renewed their licenses online. That number rose as high as 3,000 weekly after the pandemic began and has leveled off to around 1,500 a week. It's all been a change, but one that, for the most part, people have been agreeable to. I think people are adapting well, Fertig said. It's so much better. People are happy they don't have to wait as long. And that's no joke. USDA plans additional $14 billion for farmers reeling from virus. The federal government said Friday that it will give farmers an additional $14 billion to compensate them for the difficulties they have experienced selling their crops, milk, and meat because of the coronavirus pandemic. The U.S. Department of Agriculture released details of its plan that it said will provide financial assistance that gives producers the ability to absorb increased marketing costs associated with the COVID-19 pandemic. President Donald Trump first mentioned the aid in a speech Thursday night in Wisconsin, a presidential battleground state that is considered vital for his chances to win a second term. The additional payments illustrate the importance of farmers as a voting bloc to Trump's reelection. He addressed them in Wisconsin directly, saying, "You gotta love Trump," and promising favorable trade and regulatory changes as well as tax cuts. "Now we have to get 4 more years to cement it and to do additional things," he said. The coronavirus pandemic has created several problems for farmers. Lowered availability of labor has reduced crop and livestock production, as well as processing capacity in meatpacking plants and other facilities. These problems have pushed prices that farmers receive for commodities lower. They've also seen a drop in demand for some products as fewer people have been eating out. Farm households also have suffered from loss of income from off-farm jobs that they use to fund farm production needs, household living expenses, and payments on farm business debt. Agriculture groups applauded the additional money, much of which will come in direct payments for crops that meet a specified threshold of price decline. They include corn, soybeans, wheat, and some cotton. Chicken, eggs, milk, beef cattle, pigs, and lambs also will be covered, as will tobacco, wool, alfalfa, oats, peanuts, rice, and hemp. Farmers can begin signing up for the money on Monday. "We listened to feedback received from farmers, ranchers, and agricultural organizations about the impact of the pandemic on our nation's farms and ranches, and we developed a program to better meet the needs of those impacted," Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue said in a statement. The program places a payment cap of $250,000 per person or farm entity for all commodities combined. Gross income can't be more than $900,000 unless at least 75% or more of their income is derived from farming, ranching, or forestry-related activities. In April, the administration rolled out a $19 billion program, most of which was in the form of direct farm payments. That followed $28 billion the federal government gave farmers to compensate for 2 years of disruptions caused by Trump's tariff battles with trading partners. Some crop and livestock groups have criticized the way previous aid was divided, and National Farmers Union President Rob LaRue made it clear in a statement that farmers want the money distributed fairly. "The first round of funding, though greatly appreciated, was not without its flaws," LaRue said. "Not only did it favor large farms over smaller ones, it also sent millions of dollars to foreign-owned operations and excluded some farmers entirely." He asked for congressional oversight and for the USDA to ensure that payments are commensurate with demonstrated need. Scott Irwin, a University of Illinois professor who focuses on agricultural markets, said the federal payments have offset a triple whammy of low commodity prices, a trade war with China, and a drop in demand due to the coronavirus. "It's hard to overstate how much the payments have helped some Midwest corn and soybean farmers," Irwin noted, saying that a University of Illinois analysis found that in 2019, various federal support programs were responsible for 90% of a median grain operation's net farm income in Illinois. "It has basically stopped the agricultural boat from leaking," Irwin said. "It's been so big under President Trump that at least for the time being, the financial picture in agriculture is not going backward." Even as federal support has been responsible for more than one-third of U.S. net farm income in 2020, Irwin said many farmers still are struggling because of poor prices. "No one is getting rich from all of this aid because the market prices have been so low, but it has stopped the bleeding financially," Irwin said. The money for the farm programs comes from the Commodity Credit Corporation, which was created in 1933. It has authority from Congress to borrow up to $30 billion from the U.S. Treasury and private lending agencies. With the latest round of aid, the CCC may deplete its current limits, requiring a continuing resolution by Congress to replenish its funding, said John Newton, chief economist for the American Farm Bureau Federation. Iowa prison population drops to 20-year low. Iowa's prison population is below 8,000 for the first time in 20 years as officials try to stem coronavirus outbreaks at several facilities. Iowa's nine prisons had 7,406 offenders as of Friday morning, still above the system's capacity of 6,933, but well below the nearly 8,494 offenders the system held in early April. With nearly 1,100 fewer offenders, prison officials have been able to quarantine inmates with the virus and create presumptive positive units for others who have been exposed. We've had COVID in three of our prisons with significant spread, and we've been able to contain it, State Department of Corrections Director Beth Skinner told the Board of Corrections on Friday. The Iowa Medical and Classification Center in Coralville has had two outbreaks, one in April and one that started in August and is ongoing, Skinner said. Of the center's 722 offenders, 50 have tested positive in the latest surge, the department reported on its COVID-19 website. Seven of its staff members have positive tests now. The Mount Pleasant Correctional Facility has 130 positive cases among offenders and four among staff. Fort Dodge had a major outbreak earlier in the summer. Since March, Iowa's prison system has had 833 offenders and 126 staff test positive for COVID-19, with four offenders who have died from the disease, Skinner said. More than 115,000 inmates nationwide had contracted the virus as of September 1st, according to a report by the Associated Press and the Marshall Project. The 10% reduction in Iowa prisoners from the fiscal 2019 end-of-year census to 2020 was caused, in part, by the state expediting parole for older or sicker offenders, but also by delays in court proceedings and requests by the prison system for county jails to hold some offenders longer. Since May, we have shut down admissions twice now, Skinner said. We have about 214 individuals sitting in jails waiting to come to IMCC. Corrections Department requests to put off transfers from county jails to the Medical and Classification Center, which processes all adult prisoners before they go to other facilities, contributed to a 13% decline in admissions overall for fiscal 2020. When we study the data, it appears that the single largest factor that has resulted in the reduced prison population was when the admissions were suspended when IMCC experienced their first outbreak of COVID-19 this spring, Department spokesman Cord Overton said. But officials in Lynn and Johnson counties, two of the largest counties in the state, said these delays wouldn't have made that big of a difference. I'm not sure why the numbers are down, but it's not like we're keeping people in the county jails instead of sending them to the prisons, said Lynn County Captain Pete Wilson. I think it's kind of slowed down in the courts. Since March 14th, only emergency and essential Iowa court hearings have been held face-to-face. The judicial branch conducts some business through video conference or teleconference, but many proceedings have been stalled during the pandemic. The court system, for lack of a better word, shut down and trials haven't been happening, Johnson County Captain John Good said. Trials start up again Monday under state Supreme Court guidelines. Nine eastern Iowa jails surveyed by the Gazette in late March showed they together had reduced their populations by more than 30% from the beginning of that month. They did this by furloughing inmates who were serving shorter sentences for nonviolent crimes and those on work release. Johnson County judges were allowing arresting officers to cite and release people for lower-level offenses rather than taking them to jail. The ACLU Iowa is glad prison numbers are down, something the group wanted for years. It's evidence that in the course of a couple of months, the prison population was reduced and the sky didn't fall down, said Daniel Zeno, Policy and Advocacy Director. Zeno would like to see Iowa continue to reduce the number of people locked up in the first place. That's where we have to do more work. Should people be going to jail for a variety of crimes, or can they be issued a citation or sent to a diversion program? The number of people paroled from Iowa's prison system went up from 2,595 in fiscal 2019 to 3,023 in fiscal 2020, a 16.5% increase, state data show. The Board of Parole, mindful of trying to reduce the prison population during COVID-19, took steps that included allowing two boards to work simultaneously to release more offenders who were not considered high risk, said Lynn Hicks, spokesman for the Iowa Attorney General. The board and department have identified logical targets relative to expedited release options in light of this current COVID-19 reality, Board Vice Chair Andrew Bettinger said in an April 3rd news release. While Iowa is the only state in the country that doesn't have a compassionate release law, which allows early release for terminal illness, extreme old age, or sickness, the Corrections Department and Parole Board have worked to identify more offenders who could be paroled during the pandemic. We look at people 60 and over or people with significant health concerns to see if they would be a good candidate for release, Skinner said. We have to keep in mind public safety. In prisons with outbreaks, offenders are tested for COVID-19 at least once a week, Skinner told the Gazette in an interview Friday. We are pretty much testing everyone at this point in time to be on the safe side, she said. In facilities without active cases, staff do temperature and symptom checks, and if an offender has symptoms, he or she is tested. The department's medical staff has been working with the Iowa Department of Public Health and county health departments to monitor positivity rates in the community and in the prisons to determine testing frequency, Skinner said. Skinner said she has visited every prison with positive cases and talked with inmates who are confined to their cells much of the day without visitors and group activities. Some are frustrated, she said, but they have a pretty good attitude, understanding we are going to get through this and we are looking out for their safety. Dr. Jerry Greenfield, Department Health Services Administrator, told the Corrections Board that offenders who are in isolation now have shorter quarantines than in April because medical staff have learned more about COVID-19's contagious period. The department also allows offenders to have more books, music, personal property, and drinks like Gatorade. The department has psychologists in each prison facility to work with offenders who are feeling more anxiety or depression because of lockdowns. The Corrections Department has completed its review of how the Medical and Classification Center followed COVID-19 procedures leading up to its first outbreak in April, Skinner said. This review led to the abrupt retirement May 8th of former warden James McKinney, the Gazette reported. We had very clear guidelines in our pandemic policy, Skinner said, referring to rules about cleaning prisons, wearing personal protective equipment, and keeping offenders socially distant when possible. We had some indicators early on at IMCC that protocols might not have been followed. We stepped in to ensure staff and incarcerated were safe. The Corrections Board in July appointed Mike Heinreisi as the new warden. Skinner said she could not comment on specific steps that were taken after the review. We tightened things down, she said. We wanted to make sure all our prisons are following those guidelines. Skinner thanked offenders and their families for patience during the pandemic. She said prison staff are the heroes for doing difficult jobs while wearing masks, shields, and other gear, and for working to keep offenders safe. Timeline of COVID-19 and Iowa prisons. March 14th, Iowa Department of Corrections cancels all visits because of COVID-19. March 22nd, Governor Kim Reynolds announces Iowa prisoners will make masks, gowns, and hand sanitizer to supply the state for protection against the virus. April 8th, first DOC staff member, an officer at the Iowa Medical and Classification Center in Coralville, tests positive for the virus. April 18th, first Iowa inmate, an offender booked into IMCC, tests positive. April 18th, Iowa DOC reaches out to county jails, asking officials to send new admissions to IMCC only on very special circumstances because of positive cases there. April 22nd, DOC expands COVID-19 testing, has 10 new positive cases at IMCC. April 30th, inmate at Clarinda Correctional Facility tests positive. May 6th, corrections officials again ask county jails to only send to IMCC inmates with special circumstances. May 8th, IMCC warden James McKinney abruptly retires after DOC Director Beth Skinner announces reviewing COVID-19 procedures at the institution. July 1st, inmate tests positive at Fort Dodge Correctional Facility. July 7th, Ray Allen Van Lengen, 71, who was incarcerated at Fort Dodge Correctional Center, becomes first Iowa prison inmate to die of COVID-19. July 10th, Fort Dodge outbreak spreads to more than 100 inmates, KWWL-TV reports. July 10, inmate tests positive at Mount Pleasant Correctional Facility. July 10th, Iowa Board of Corrections approves Mike Heinrichy as next IMCC warden. August 10th, IMCC temporarily suspends admissions due to state increase in cases. Medical marijuana dispensary license approved for Coralville. A state-licensed medical marijuana dispensary may open in Coralville, which would be the first in the corridor. The Iowa Department of Public Health announced Thursday it plans to award two new medical marijuana dispensary licenses, one to the Iowa Cannabis Company East in Coralville and one to the Cannabis Patient Network in Council Bluffs. The firms have until Friday to accept. Otherwise, the state could choose among five other applications, including two for Cedar Rapids and two others in the Iowa City area that meet the state's minimum criteria. The new licenses follow the March closures of dispensaries in Davenport and Council Bluffs. The state still has licensed dispensaries in Waterloo, Sioux City, and Windsor Heights. Iowa law allows only five dispensary licenses. There have been other setbacks this year for medical marijuana entrepreneurs in Iowa. Iowa Relief, a medical marijuana manufacturer in Cedar Rapids, closed earlier this year and turned in its license. It was one of two manufacturers licensed in Iowa to produce the medical marijuana products sold to qualifying patients at the dispensaries. The other is MedFarm Iowa of Des Moines. Iowa Relief, owned by New Jersey-based Acreage Holdings, produced capsules, topical ointments, and tinctures for the state's medical cannabidiol program for less than a year. Companies interested in Iowa's medical marijuana program have said it won't take off until lawmakers allow higher levels of tetrahydrocannabinol, or THC, the compound that produces a high feeling. Last summer, the Iowa legislature passed and Governor Kim Reynolds signed into law House File 2589, which removed a 3% THC limit on products but replaced it with a limit of 4.5 grams of THC per 90-day purchase, with some exceptions. A year earlier, Reynolds vetoed a bill that would have lifted the cap and allowed 25 grams of THC in 90 days. The new law also added for 2020 post-traumatic stress disorder and severe autism as conditions qualifying for medical marijuana. Trump decision to bolster ethanol becomes campaign flashpoint. President Donald Trump has been receiving praise from farm state Republicans for his decision to deny the gap year waivers and increase access to E15 corn-based ethanol, but it also was panned by Democrats Wednesday as nothing more than a political ploy. "What the administration has done is really an insult," said Michigan U.S. Senator Debbie Stabenow, ranking Democrat on the Agriculture Committee. "It would be welcome news if it was at the beginning of a Trump presidency, but already the damage has been done. So our farmers are hurting, and they need more than just some lip service right before the election," Stabenow said Wednesday on a call organized by Biden for President. Trump has failed to deliver on the promises he made to Midwestern farmers 4 years ago: better trade deals, investments in rural infrastructure, and support for the renewable fuel industry, added former Iowa Governor Tom Vilsack. The reality 3.5 years later, as we approach the election, is that President Trump has failed to keep any of these promises, said Vilsack, who served as President Barack Obama's U.S. Department of Agriculture Secretary for 8 years and now leads the U.S. Dairy Export Council. Now, at this late date, he becomes a Johnny-come-lately to the third promise of supporting the RFS. Trump and the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency denied waivers petroleum refiners had sought retroactively, some as far back as 2011, that would have allowed the petroleum industry to remove hundreds of millions of gallons of corn-based ethanol from the market and sidestep a congressional requirement of blending at least 15 billion gallons of ethanol a year into the nation's fuel supply. "The president's action is a big deal," according to Iowa's two Republican U.S. senators who had lobbied the president to deny the waivers and remove outdated restrictions on the year-round sale of E15. I applaud President Trump for keeping his word in supporting our farmers and biofuel producers, Senator Chuck Grassley said. This is an important step that will allow more gas stations to provide E15 to Iowans year-round without significantly changing their infrastructure. Senator Joni Ernst said the Trump administration listened to the call for action from her, Grassley, and other supporters of the RFS. The president's move will provide more certainty to biofuel producers who have for too long been yanked around by the EPA, Ernst said. Ernst on Wednesday received the Fueling Growth Award for the sixth consecutive year from Growth Energy, a trade association, for her support of biofuels. Her Democratic challenger, Teresa Greenfield, said the president's decisions does nothing to erase the damage Senator Ernst did by voting for a fossil fuel lobbyist to run the EPA. Unlike Ernst, I'll always put our farmers first, not big oil donors. You are listening to the reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for Saturday, September 19, 2020, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, let's turn to today's obituaries. Shirley A. Rasmussen. Shirley Ann Rasmussen, 62, of Bartow, Florida, formerly of Clear Lake, passed away Friday, September 11th, at home with her family. There will be a celebration of life in Clear Lake to be planned for a later date. Shirley was born December 20th, 1957, to Troy and Anna Connor Knapp in Wheaton, Minnesota. She graduated from Charles City High School in 1976 before going on to graduate from NIAC and the University of Northern Iowa with her bachelor's degree in elementary education. Shirley married Joel Rasmussen on July 23, 1980, in Clear Lake, and to this union, two children were born, Adam and Alicia. In her free time, Shirley enjoyed spending her time outdoors. She was a board member of the Lake Area Outdoor Classroom in Clear Lake for years and volunteered to run a middle school environmental club, the Earth Keepers. Shirley loved working at Cabin Coffee in Clear Lake. Her co-workers and the customers were like a second family. She was an avid Green Bay Packers fan and Tampa Bay Lightning hockey fan. Some of her favorite memories were from camping and traveling while the kids were growing up. Becoming a grandma and spoiling her grandchildren brought her so much joy. Left to cherish her memory are her children, Adam Rasmussen and spouse Samantha of Cheney, Kansas, and Alicia Hansen and spouse Justin of Bartow, Florida. Her grandchildren, Oliver Rasmussen and Violet Hansen. Her brother-in-law, Jim Rasmussen and spouse Joanne, and sister-in-law, June Irwin. Nieces and nephews, Kate Walker and spouse Jake, Daniel Rasmussen, James Vierkant and spouse Sherry, Ben Irwin, Matt Irwin, John Irwin, Dusty Knapp, and Jamie Knapp, and her great-niece and nephews, Haley Vierkant, Isaac Walker, and Truman Walker. Shirley was preceded in death by her husband, Joel Rasmussen, her parents, Troy and Anna Knapp, her parents-in-law, Wayland and Margaret Rasmussen, and nephew, Eric Knapp. Shirley's family suggests memorial contributions be made to the Center for Great Apes, P.O. Box 488, Wachula, Florida, 33873, or online at centerforgreatapes.org. Merle V. Marshall. Merle Vincent Marshall, 80, of Garner, died Thursday, September 17th, at his home. Per Merle's wishes, his body has been cremated and a memorial service will be announced in the near future. Larry D. Pops Co., 1938 to 2020. Larry Dwayne Pops Coe, 82, of Ventura, died Wednesday, September 16th, at Mercy One North Iowa Medical Center in Mason City. A celebration of life will be held at 10:30 a.m. Monday, September 21st, at the Ventura Community Center, 4 Weimer Street, Ventura. Visitation will be held from 4 to 6 p.m. Sunday, September 20th, at Ward Venslight Colonial Chapel, 310 First Avenue North, Clear Lake. In lieu of customary remembrances, a memorial will be established in Larry's name to an appropriate cause or organization to be determined later. Larry was born March 8, 1938, the son of Wilbur and Blanche Porter Coe in Ventura. He married Mary Jane Nagel on September 5, 1958, at the Ventura United Methodist Church. She preceded him in death on September 20, 2019. Larry graduated from Ventura High School in 1956. Early in his life, he worked at the Ventura Elevator and would later retire from Coke Pipeline Services. During retirement, he took pride in working for Rolling Family Farms. Larry enjoyed being outdoors and any hobby that took place outdoors, including fishing, hunting, trap shooting, and raising horses. He helped start the Brit Draft Horse Show with Dave Adams, liked taking fishing trips to Canada, and cherished the time spent teaching his grandchildren how to fish, hunt, and trap shoot. Most of all, Larry was a family man. His family and grandchildren were his number one priority, and it was on display every day. He loved making daily trips to the farm and most recently taking trips around the lake with his great-grandson, Clay. Larry is survived by three children, Mary Schrader and spouse Jeff, Connie Carter and P.J. Kruger and spouse Mike, eight grandchildren, J.D. Schrader and spouse Jessica, Andy Carter and spouse Danielle, Craig Carter and spouse Cassandra, Logan Smith and spouse Chelsea, Tucker Schrader and spouse Shelby, Jessica Rasmussen and spouse Randy, Zach Kruger and spouse Irene, and Nick Kruger and spouse Emma. Nine great-grandchildren, Cheyenne, Aiden, Clay, Allison, Addison, Anderson, baby Andy, Everly, Caitlin, Brooks, and a great-grandson due in November. A sister-in-law, Irene Coe, and many nieces and nephews. He was preceded in death by his parents, wife, siblings, Joy, Courier, and spouse Harold, Ted and Evelina, Kenneth and spouse Nan, Cecil, Frosty and spouse Jenny, and Cleo Overgaard and spouse Bill, and a son-in-law, Randy Castor. Phyllis J. Galloway Morrison, 1924 to 2020. Phyllis Jean Galloway Morrison, 96 going on 100, died of complications due to the coronavirus at Ridgecrest Village in Davenport on Monday, September 7th. She was born August 13, 1924, in the Washington County Hospital. Phyllis lived happily with her parents, Earl and Ruth Galloway. They moved to Garden City, Kansas, when she graduated from high school in 1942, and then relocated back to their Washington farm. She attended Iowa State Teachers College and enjoyed playing percussion instruments, bands, and orchestras in high school and college. Phyllis and Donald were married November 23, 1949. Don was employed as a branch manager of GMAC. Retiring in 1980, along with their two sons, Robert and Richard, they enjoyed their home in Clear Lake, where they were involved in many community activities in both Clear Lake and Mason City. She was most interested in Monday Club, president and life member, bridge clubs, book clubs, sculpturing, china painting, and needlework. She was also past president of the Ventura Garden Club, life member, Pi Phi Omega Sorority, life member, and the Clear Lake Women's Club. On clear days, they could be found in the lake with friends in their houseboat. In 2009, Don and Phyllis moved to their present home in Ridgecrest Village, Davenport. She was preceded in death by her husband, Donald, a son, Bob, her parents, two brothers, David and Robert Galloway, and sisters, Helen Scott and Mary Ruth Owens. Phyllis is survived by her son, Richard Morrison, and spouse Rose, daughter-in-law Norma, five grandsons and their wives, four great-grandsons, and two great-granddaughters. Burial will be in Elm Grove Cemetery in Washington. Any memorial should be directed to the Ridgecrest Foundation, 4130 Northwest Boulevard, Davenport, Iowa, 52806. Online condolences may be made to Phyllis's family by visiting her obituary at wertsfh.com. And Wertz is W-E-E-R-T-S. Saints offensive line powers rushing attack through Warhawks. Seniors Ryan Cole and Carter Saltz and junior Lauren Isler combined to form a unique rushing attack for St. Ansgar that's tough for North Iowa football teams to defend. The three were on display again in a 54-21 homecoming win over West Fork on Friday night. The backfield combined for over 400 rushing yards and eight total touchdowns. Saltz had a team-high six touchdown runs, and Cole and Isler each had one in the win over the Warhawks. Typically, the guys who score the touchdowns are the ones who get the spotlight, and that's normally the case for Cole, Saltz, and Isler. Those guys couldn't do it without the fellas up front, who typically work in silence. They bring it every day, head coach Drew Clevenger said. It's not a glorious position, but they're a pretty hard-nosed crew. They take a lot of pride, and they battle for each other. Friday night's starting five consisted of seniors Colin Ubben, Sage Holzeicher, and Alex Hansen, and juniors Casey Heeman and Jex Schuchter. It's not uncommon for their work to go unnoticed, but they like it better that way. "It's a good thing," Ubben said. "We want them to get all the credit, and we just want to be back and doing our job." The Saints are ranked second in the Class A Associated Press poll and now sit at a perfect 4-0 record. With 17 total rushing touchdowns in four games, St. Ansgar's rushing attack is known as one of the best in the state. "Our style of football maybe isn't as aesthetically pleasing as some of the spread stuff, but we like getting after it up front," Clevenger said. "We like to play that way here, and our guys certainly take pride in it. The physical downhill style of offense is great when you have three different capable rushers." Cole gave his guys plenty of credit after the win on Friday night. "These guys do pretty much everything for us," Cole said. "If there's not a hole, there's nowhere we can run, and we can't get any yards, so it's all up to the linemen. They're a great group of guys, and I love to have them on my team." It didn't look like the Saints were going to win by 33 points at the start of the night. The Warhawks, fresh off a 35-6 victory over Newman Catholic, came out hot on offense, and St. Ansgar struggled to stop them. Salts capped off St. Ansgar's opening drive with a 6-yard touchdown run to put the Saints up 7-0 right away. The Warhawks answered when senior quarterback Caden Ames went 4-for-4 on the opening drive and threw a 9-yard touchdown pass to senior Ren Heimer. The Saints and Warhawks traded touchdowns again on the next two possessions, and the score was 14-14 after just one quarter of play. Ryan Cole scored his only rushing touchdown of the night on a 10-yard run at the start of the second quarter to make the score 21-14. Again, Ames and the Warhawks offense responded. This time, Ames hit senior Kellen Cameron on a 12-yard touchdown pass to even the score at 21-21. That would be the last time the Warhawks scored. The Saints went on to score 33 unanswered points over the course of the rest of the game. "They made some adjustments, and honestly, we just couldn't stop them defensively," West Fork head coach James Perez said. "They kind of did what they wanted. I think they had almost 500 yards total offense, and they've just got some guys and some size. They're well coached, and they do things right." While St. Ansgar looked like it is deserving of the number two spot in the rankings, Clevenger knows the team can't get too caught up in them. "I can tell you just off the top of my head, there's a lot of things that we're going to need to fix," Clevenger said. "We want to be a better football team next Friday than we are this week." West Fork drops to 2-1 on the year, and St. Ansgar improves to 4-0. The Warhawks play at home against Nashua Plainfield next Friday, and St. Ansgar will travel to North Butler. Carter Thomas leads Mason City to homecoming night win. As far as birthday presents go, it is hard to think of a better gift for John Lee than the one his team gave him on Friday night. On Lee's 50th birthday, which also happened to be senior night and homecoming at Mason City, the Mason City football team improved to 2-0 with a 26-12 win over Boone in front of the home fans. It was the team's second straight home win, dating back to their October 26, 2019 victory over Ottumwa in the regular season finale. For the Mohawks, the star of the day was junior wide receiver Carter Thomas. Thomas had a big night on both sides of the ball, finishing with 5 receptions for 94 yards, 3 touchdowns, and 2 interceptions. He nearly came away with a third pick, but the pass bounced off his hands, much to Thomas's chagrin. "I was frustrated," Thomas said. "That was one of the last plays of the first half, and I dropped that. There was a lot of green ahead of me, and I started peeking downfield." Thomas kicked off the scoring for Mason City at 8 minutes 6 seconds in the first quarter when he caught a 16-yard touchdown pass from senior quarterback Connor Dalen. The Mohawks extended the lead to 10-0 early in the second quarter when senior Eric Lensing hit a 43-yard field goal. With around 4 minutes left in the second quarter, Thomas intercepted a pass from Boone quarterback Cole Burge, setting up a drive that started at the 25-yard line for Mason City. Later in the drive, Thomas cut a 61-yard pass from sophomore quarterback Cale Hobart, a score that put the Mohawks up 17-0. The play was the first touchdown pass of Hobart's varsity football career. "It was how we drew it up," Hobart said. "I didn't expect him to go that far, but it was a great play by Carter on that one." After consecutive 3 and outs by both squads, Boone got the ball at the 25-yard line. On the first play of the drive, Thomas intercepted another pass from Burge, which gave the Mohawks the ball at the 44. That drive concluded with a 44-yard field goal from Lensing, and at halftime, Mason City led the Toreadors 20-0. On the Mohawks' first drive of the second half, Thomas scored his third touchdown of the night, this one by accident. On a Mohawk's first and 10 at the 21, Dalen kept the ball at a quarterback keeper, but fumbled it when he was tackled. Thomas picked the ball up off the ground and ran into the end zone, a score that put Mason City up 26-0. "He's such a competitor and such a good athlete," Lee said. "That is the stuff that we all know Carter can do. He finds the ball offensively and defensively. He can make plays, and it's going to give other guys opportunities too." Thomas was thrilled with the win and gave credit to the home crowd for its energy. Despite the student section being limited to 180 tickets due to COVID-19, the crowd was loud and energetic the entire game. "It was awesome. We had a huge crowd. Shout out to all of them," Thomas said. "Shout out to the school for supporting, even though we only could have 180. That was awesome. The community really helped us. We appreciate it." The other standout of the night for the Mohawks was Lensing. The Mohawks' senior kicker finished with two field goals over 40 yards and had a standout night punting the ball. Lensing punted four times for the Mohawks, his longest a 40-yarder, which came in the second quarter. "Eric can really kick the ball," Lee said. "He has really dedicated himself to the craft of kicking. He takes it very seriously." In football parlance, the saying goes, a win is a win, and Lee was overall very happy with the team's performance, though he would have liked to have seen fewer penalties. The Mohawks wound up with two unsportsmanlike conduct penalties on the night and were flagged a total of 9 times in the game. "We did some really good things, but we really left some points out there, and defensively we missed a lot of tackles," Lee said. "We had some horrible decisions made on just talking back to the team, our penalties. We didn't play a clean game, but we got out of here with a good victory. We'll take it." Friday night was homecoming in many ways. It was the Mohawks' first home football game in 329 days and was Lee's first game on the sideline at Mohawk Stadium since October 28, 2009. After 10 years away, the chance to coach again in front of the home fans meant a lot to the Mason City head coach. With the win last year over Ottumwa and the 28-0 opening week victory over Marshalltown on August 28th, the Mohawks now have the program's first 3-game winning streak in 11 years. "It was fantastic," Lee said. "Marshalltown was exciting and fun to be back. But to be home at Mohawk Stadium with the crowd and the music and senior night, it was special for me. It was a great way to celebrate my birthday." Mason City will play next Friday at 7 p.m. at Webster City. Guest columnist Bob Jensen. Catch walleyes at night. "Although I don't do it as much as I used to, I still enjoy getting after walleyes at night. Across all of walleye country, there are lots of places where you can catch them under the cover of the moon. They can be caught casting from shore or trolling in a boat. Another appealing aspect is that the presentations are pretty simple. We cast either a crankbait or a jig tipped with plastic. An angler that's trying to catch walleyes at night can get all the baits needed into a small tackle box. Here's how you can take part in this walleye action that's going on right now. There are lots of bodies of water across the range of the walleye that will provide big fish. Some lakes, rivers, or reservoirs have a reputation for turning out trophies. If the walleye of a lifetime is your goal, center your efforts on those water systems. Often the best trophy walleye producers will be large, deep lakes with clear water. Not always, but often. Lakes such as this are home to bait fish that make the walleyes fat. The food in deep, clear lakes makes walleyes heavy, and because the water is clear, the walleyes can often be easier to catch at night. But there's another reason why the walleyes go on a night bite in the fall. Those bait fish that make the walleyes grow big are fall spawners. They're in the shallows laying their eggs at a time of year when the walleyes are interested in adding some fat to their body to get them through the winter months. Those bait fish are very susceptible to hungry walleyes when they're in those shallow areas. To take advantage of this nighttime opportunity, you need to do a couple of things. First, you need to identify a potential hotspot. The fall spawning bait fish will usually spawn in shallow water that is close to deep water. Shorelines or offshore shallow sand or rock areas will be good starting points. In lakes that don't have fall spawning bait fish, a night bite can still occur. Look for areas with current. Go out during the day to current areas and see if bait fish are present. If they are, walleyes will visit at night. If you'll be fishing from a boat, make sure the boat is clear of unneeded equipment and know where all the equipment that you might need is. You don't want to be looking for baits or a net or hookouts when the fish are biting. If you'll be wading, check out the area for rocks or logs under the water that you could trip on. Arrive at your spot before the sun goes down and get set up. Keep quiet. When fish are shallow, they're oftentimes spooky. Now, about the lures. When trolling, a traditional walleye crankbait such as a lucky shad will usually do the job. If you're casting to water less than 5 feet deep, a KVD jerkbait might be better. Use the largest size that the fish will hit. If they won't hit the crankbaits, try a jig tipped with an action tail plastic. Much of the time, you'll have the water to yourself at night this time of year. If you get on a good walleye body of water at night now and for the next few weeks, your chances for action in a truly big one are very good. Justice Ginsburg dies at 87. Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, a diminutive yet towering women's rights champion who became the court's second female justice, died Friday at her home in Washington. She was 87. Ginsburg died of complications from metastatic pancreatic cancer, the court said. Chief Justice John Roberts mourned Ginsburg's passing. Our nation has lost a jurist of historic stature. We at the Supreme Court have lost a cherished colleague. Today we mourn, but with confidence that future generations will remember Ruth Bader Ginsburg as we knew her, a tireless and resolute champion of justice, Roberts said in a statement. Ginsburg announced in July that she was undergoing chemotherapy treatment for lesions on her liver, the latest of her several battles with cancer. She spent her final years on the bench as the unquestioned leader of the court's liberal wing and became something of a rock star to her admirers. Young women especially seemed to embrace the court's Jewish grandmother, affectionately calling her the notorious RBG for her defense of the rights of women and minorities and the strength and resilience she displayed in the face of personal loss and health crises. Those health problems included 5 bouts with cancer beginning in 1999, falls that resulted in broken ribs, insertion of a stent to clear a blocked artery, and assorted other hospitalizations after she turned 75. She resisted calls by liberals to retire during Barack Obama's presidency at a time when Democrats held the Senate and a replacement with similar views could have been confirmed. Instead, Trump will almost certainly try to push Ginsburg's successor through the Republican-controlled Senate and move the conservative court even more to the right. Ginsburg antagonized Trump during the 2016 presidential campaign in a series of media interviews, including calling him a faker. She soon apologized. Her appointment by President Bill Clinton in 1993 was the first by a Democrat in 26 years. She initially found a comfortable ideological home somewhere left of center on a conservative court dominated by Republican appointees. Her liberal voice grew stronger the longer she served. Ginsburg was a mother of two, an opera lover, and an intellectual who watched arguments behind oversized glasses for many years, though she ditched them for more fashionable frames in her later years. At argument sessions in the ornate courtroom, she was known for digging deep into case records and for being a stickler for following the rules. She argued 6 key cases before the court in the 1970s when she was an architect of the women's rights movement. She won 5. Ruth Bader Ginsburg does not need a seat on the Supreme Court to earn her a place in the American history books, Clinton said at the time of her appointment. She has already done that. On the court, where she was known as a facile writer, most significant majority opinions were the 1996 ruling that ordered the Virginia Military Institute to accept women or give up its state funding, and the 2015 decision that upheld independent commissions some states used to draw congressional districts. Besides civil rights, Ginsburg took an interest in capital punishment, voting repeatedly to limit its use. During her tenure, the court declared it unconstitutional for states to execute the intellectually disabled and killers younger than 18. In addition, she questioned the quality of lawyers for poor accused murderers. In the most divisive of cases, including the Bush versus Gore decision in 2000, she was often at odds with the court's more conservative members. Initially, Chief Justice William H. Rehnquist and Justices Sandra Day O'Connor, Antonin Scalia, Anthony M. Kennedy, and Clarence Thomas. The division remained the same after John Roberts replaced Rehnquist as Chief Justice, Samuel Alito took O'Connor's seat, and, under Trump, Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh joined the court, in seats that had been held by Scalia and Kennedy, respectively. Ginsburg would say later that the 5-4 decision that settled the 2000 presidential election for Republican George W. Bush was a breathtaking episode at the court. She was perhaps personally closest on the court to Scalia, her ideological opposite. Ginsburg once explained that she took Scalia's sometimes biting dissents as a challenge to be met. "How am I going to answer this in a way that's a real put-down?" she said. Ginsburg authored powerful dissents of her own in cases involving abortion, voting rights, and pay discrimination against women. She said some were aimed at swaying the opinions of her fellow judges, while others were an appeal to the intelligence of another day in the hopes that they would provide guidance to future courts. "Hope springs eternal," she said in 2007, "and when I am writing a dissent, I'm always hoping for that fifth or sixth vote, even though I'm disappointed more often than not." She wrote memorably in 2013 that the court's decision to cut out a key part of the federal law that had ensured the voting rights of Black people, Hispanics, and other minorities was like throwing away your umbrella in a rainstorm because you are not getting wet. Change on the court hit Ginsburg especially hard. She dissented forcefully from the court's decision in 2007 to uphold a nationwide ban on an abortion procedure that opponents call partial birth abortion. The court, with O'Connor still on it, had struck down a similar state ban 7 years earlier. "The alarming ruling," Ginsburg said, "cannot be understood as anything other than an effort to chip away at a right declared again and again by this court, and with an increasing comprehension of its centrality to women's lives." In 1999, Ginsburg had surgery for colon cancer and received radiation and chemotherapy. She had surgery again in 2009 after being diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, and in December 2018 for cancerous growths on her left lung. Following the last surgery, she missed court sessions for the first time in more than 25 years on the bench. Ginsburg also was treated with radiation for a tumor on her pancreas in August 2019. She maintained an active schedule even during the 3 weeks of radiation. When she revealed a recurrence of her cancer in July 2020, Ginsburg said she remained fully able to continue as a justice. And that does it for today's reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for Saturday, September 19th, 2020. I'm your reader, Leanne Bakerose. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thanks for listening.